Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is David Robilevsky, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle, published by Echo. In the weeks to come, we have Jeff Shara and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. By purchasing your books at the Tattered Cover, you enable us to continue to bring great authors to our podium. And speaking of great writers, we are so fortunate to be here at the threshold of what promises to be an incredible writing career. David Robleski is with us to present his debut novel, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle, a story that has been receiving heaps of praise, including a starred Kirkus Review, which hails it as, quote, an auspicious debut. A boon for dog lovers and for fans of storytelling that eschews flash. Highly recommended. Much has been made of Stephen King's incredible blurb, which states, wonderful, mysterious, long, and satisfying. Readers who pick up this novel are going to enter a richer world. And recently, the Washington Post proclaims, quote, the final section gathers like a furious storm of hope and retribution and transforms the story of this little family into something grand and unforgettable. A software programmer until very recently, David earned his master's degree from the Warren Wilson MFA program. His dedication to this novel is clear. In an interview with NewWest.net, he talks of the decade-long process of writing Edgar Sawtelle. A long project like Edward comes to feel almost like a lifestyle. There's always a draft that needs fixing. There always will be a next draft, he says. Well, tonight, we are here to applaud David's work and to celebrate the arrival of his bound pages to our bookshelves. Frequently in attendance as a member of our audience at many of our book signings, it is with great pleasure and celebration that I now invite him, as author, to our podium. Please welcome David Robleski.
Thanks. Christine, that was lovely. Thanks. I want to begin by thanking the Tattered Cover for inviting me here tonight. It is a real honor and a thrill to be standing here in a bookstore that I know so well. The Tattered is one of the legendary bookstores in this country, and that alone makes it a really special occasion. It's also a very special occasion for me and for this book, as Christine said, because this is the launch of the book tour for Edgar Sawtelle. And beginning at the Tattered is just perfect. For one thing, I'm not a Colorado native, but this novel is. It was conceived and written and revised almost exclusively within a half an hour of the Tattered Cover, sometimes actually in the Tattered Cover. And there are many nights when I went home after readings at the Tattered and found the inspiration to work a little longer or a little harder or raise the bar a little higher. And I really love this Colfax Avenue location, which is a converted theater. Since one strand in the braid of Edgar's story draws from, at least indirectly, from the literature of the stage, to be reading in a space that was once devoted to stage drama and now to books feels particularly appropriate. And finally, this book would simply not have been completed without the encouragement and patience of many friends who I see in the audience tonight. And I want to, before I go any further, thank you all for that. I thought what I'd do tonight would be to talk very briefly about this story. Not a lot. I hope enough to convince you to read the book. But then I want to read a short chapter that comes at the early in the novel. And afterward, talk just a bit about how the story came about. And hopefully we'll spend as much time as possible doing Q&A afterward. For years now, I've been saying that when asked what this book is about, that the story of Edgar Sawtelle is a boy and his dog story for grown-ups. I like that as a summary. I like it a lot because, first of all, it's short. And second of all, because it conveys the spirit of this book without really saying anything at all, without giving anything away, I think, which is its greatest quality. My sense is that a novel is meant to be experienced in the mind. And almost everything that you learn about a story outside of the pages of the book puts you at a bit of a disadvantage. So I tend to stop at that point, but tonight I'm going to break my own rules and go on a little further and tell you about, a little more about the story. The setting is a small and slightly ramshackle farm in the north woods of Wisconsin, where the Sawtell family raises and trains an entirely fictional breed of dog known as Sawtell dogs, the culmination of 50 years of meticulous breeding, training, and selection for brilliance in companionship. Over the course of generations, the Sawtells have elevated the act of raising dogs to an art. Edgar, an only child, is a prodigy in this world. But like many prodigies, Edgar's unusual gifts derive in part from an equally unusual deficit. He is mute, but not deaf, and must communicate with others in a partially invented language of sign. The main part of this story takes place in 1972, when Edgar is 14 years old. That summer, three things change Edgar's world. First, Edgar is given his first litter of pups to raise from birth until they are placed. Second, a stray dog, half wild, begins to appear on their farm. And third, his father's brother returns home after an absence of many years and stays on the farm while he's getting himself established in the area. Things, of course, go awry, or there wouldn't be a novel, but I'm going to let you all discover exactly for yourself how they go awry. The chapter I'm going to read from tonight occurs early in the novel, and it introduces two of the main characters. In fact, it tells the story of Edgar's birth in 1958, as seen through the eyes of a yearling dog named Almandine. As the novel progresses, Almandine will become Edgar's nursemaid, friend, protector, and an extraordinary companion. In this passage, you'll hear references to Edgar's parents, Trudy and Gar, and the family veterinarian, Paige Papineau. There's also an old barn of gigantic proportions in this chapter, practically a character of its own in this novel, which was converted long ago to a kennel by Edgar's grandfather. Finally, you should know that in the chapter leading up to this, and this is only the second chapter in the book, it happens actually before any of the other things that I told you about happen. In the chapter leading up to this, Trudy and Gar have been trying to have a baby for quite some time. The year before, a miscarriage took place, which left Trudy devastated, and Trudy and Gar are afraid that it could happen again. Almandine, however, has other concerns. The title of this chapter is Almandine. Eventually, she understood the house was keeping a secret from her. All that winter and all through the spring, Almandine had known something was going to happen. But no matter where she looked, she couldn't find it. Sometimes, when she entered a room, there was the feeling that the thing that was going to happen had just been there. And she would stop and pant and peer around while the feeling seeped away as mysteriously as it had arrived. Weeks might pass without a sign. And then a night would come when, lying nose to tail beneath the window in the kitchen corner, listening to the murmur of conversation and the slosh and clink of dishes being washed, she felt it in the house again, and she whisked her tail across the baseboards in long, pensive strokes, and silently collected her feet beneath her and waited. When half an hour passed and nothing appeared, she groaned and sighed and rolled onto her back and waited to see if it was somewhere in her sleep. She began investigating unlikely crevices. Behind the refrigerator, where age-old layers of dust whirled into frantic life under her breath. Within the tangle of chair legs and living feet beneath the kitchen table. Inside the boots and shoes sagging in a line beside the back porch door, none with any success, though freshly baited mousetraps began to appear behind the appliances, beyond the reach of her delicate, inquisitive nose. Once, when Edgar's parents left their closet door open, she'd spent an entire morning crouched on the bedroom floor, certain she'd finally cornered the thing among the jumble of shoes and drapes of cloth. She lost patience after a while and walked to the threshold, scenting the musty darkness. And she would have begun her search in earnest, but Trudy called from the yard and she was forced to leave it be. By the time she remembered the closet, later that day, the thing was gone, and there was no telling where it might have gotten to. Sometimes, after she'd searched and failed to find the thing that was going to happen, she stood beside Edgar's mother or father and waited for them to call it out. But they'd forgotten about it, or more likely had never known in the first place. There were things like that, she'd learned. Obvious things. They didn't know. The way they ran their hands down her sides and scratched along her backbone consoled her, but the fact was she wanted a job to do. By then she'd been in the house for almost a year, away from her littermates, away from the sounds and smells of the kennel, with only the daily training work to occupy her. Now even that had become routine, and she was not the kind of dog who could be idle for long without growing unhappy. If they didn't know about this thing, it was all that much more important that she find it and show them. In April, she began to wake in the night and wander the house, pausing beside the vacant couch and the blowing furnace registers to ask what they knew, but they never answered, or knew but couldn't say. Always, at the end of those moonlight prowls, she found herself standing in the room with the crib, where, at odd moments, she might discover Trudy rearranging the chest of drawers or brushing her hand through the mobile suspended over it. From the doorway, her gaze was drawn to the rocking chair, bathed in the pale night light that filtered through the curtained window. She recalled a time when she'd slept beside that chair while Trudy rocked in the dark. She approached and dropped her nose below the seat and lifted it an inch, encouraging it to remember and tell her what more it knew, but it only tilted back and forth in silence. It was clear that the bed positively knew the secret, but it wasn't saying no matter how many times she asked. Edgar's parents awoke one night to find her dragging away the blanket in a moment of spite. In the mornings, she poked her nose at the truck, the traveler, as she thought of it, sitting petrified in the driveway, but it too kept all secrets close and made no reply. And so, near the end of that time, she could only commiserate with Trudy, who now obviously longed to find the thing as much as Almandine, and who had, for some reason, begun to spend her time lying in bed instead of going to the kennel. The idea, it seemed, was to stop hunting for the thing entirely and let the house yield up its secret on its own. There came a morning when they woke while it was still dark outside, and Gar began to rush around the house, stopping only long enough to make two quick phone calls. He threw some things into a suitcase and carried it out to the truck, and then carried it back in again and threw some more things inside. And all the while he did this, Almandine watched Trudy dress, slowly and deliberately. When she finished, she sat on the edge of the bed and said, "Relax, Gar. There's plenty of time." They walked down the steps together, and Almandine escorted the two of them to the truck. When Trudy was seated in the cab, Almandine circled back and waited for the tailgate to open, but instead Gar led her to the kennel and opened the door to an empty run. She stood in the aisle and looked at him, incredulous. "Go on," he said. She considered the temptation of the open barn door. Morning light poured in from behind Gar, casting his shadow along the dry, dusty cement floor and over her. But in the end she let him take her by the collar and lead her into the pen, which was the best she could do. Then there was the sound of the truck starting and tires on gravel. Some of the dogs barked out of habit at the noise, but Almandine was too stunned to do anything but stand in the straw and wait for the truck to return and Gar to rush back inside to get her. When she finally lay down, it was so near the door that tufts of her fur pressed through the squares of wire. Dr. Papineau arrived that evening and dished out food and water and checked on the pups. The next morning, Edgar's father returned, but he hurried through the chores, leaving Almandine in the kennel run. That evening, it was Papineau again. When the night came on, she stood in the outer kennel run, listening to the spring peepers begin their cacophony and the bats flickering overhead. And she looked at the frozen oculus of the moon as it rose above the trees and cast its blue radiance across the field. It was just cool enough for her breath to light up. And for a long time, she stood there, panting, trying to imagine what it was that was happening. Some of the other dogs pressed through the doors of their runs and stood with her. The old stone silo loomed over them. After a while, she gave up and pushed back inside and curled into a corner and set her gaze on the motionless barn doors. Another day passed, then two more. In the morning, Almandine heard the sound of the truck pulling into the yard, followed by a car. When Trudy's voice reached her, Almandine put her paws on the pen door and joined in the barking for the first time since she had been out there. Gar came out to the barn and opened her pen. She whirled in the aisle, then bolted for the back porch steps and turned there and panted over her shoulder, waiting for him to catch up. Trudy sat in her chair in the living room, a white blanket in her arms. Dr. Papineau was on the couch, hat on his lap. Almandine approached, quivering with curiosity. She slid her muzzle carefully along Trudy's shoulder, stopping just inches from the blanket, and she narrowed her eyes and inhaled a dozen short breaths. Faint huffing sounds emanated from the fabric, and a delicate pink hand jerked out. Five fingers splayed and relaxed, and so managed to express a yawn. That would be the first time Almandine saw Edgar's hands. In a way, that would be the first time she saw him make a sign. That miniature hand was so moist and pink and interesting, the temptation was almost irresistible. She pressed her nose forward another fraction of an inch. No... No licks, Trudy whispered in her ear. Almandine began to wag her tail, slowly at first, then faster, as if something long held motionless inside her had gained momentum enough to break free. The swing of her tail rocked her chest and shoulders like a counterweight. She withdrew her muzzle from across Trudy's chest and licked at the air. And with that small joke, she lost all reserve, and she play-bowed and woofed quietly. As a result, she was downstayed, but she didn't mind as long as she was in a place where she could watch. Dr. Papineau sat with them for an hour or so. Their talk sounded low and serious. Somehow, Almandine concluded that they were worried about the baby, that something wasn't right. And yet, she could see that the baby was fine. He squirmed, he breathed, he slept. When Dr. Papineau excused himself, Edgar's father went to the barn to do the chores properly for the first time in 4 days, and his mother, exhausted, looked out the windows while the infant slept. It was mid-afternoon on a spring day, brilliant, green, and cool. The house hunched quietly around them all. And then, sitting upright in her chair, Edgar's mother fell asleep. Almandine lay on the floor and watched, puzzling over something. As soon as Gar had opened the kennel door, she'd been sure that the house was about to reveal its secret, that now she would find the thing that was going to happen. When she'd seen the blanket and scented the baby, she thought maybe that was it. But it seemed to her now that wasn't right either. Whatever it was, it had to do with the baby, but it wasn't simply the fact of the baby. While Almandine pondered this, a sound reached her ears, a whispery rasp, barely audible even to her. At first, she couldn't make sense of it. The moment she'd walked into the room, she'd heard the breaths coming from the blanket, the ones that nearly matched his mother's breathing, and so it took her a moment to understand that in this new sound, she was hearing distress, to realize that in this near silence was the sound of him wailing. She waited for the sound to stop, but it went on and on, as quiet as the rustle of the new leaves on the apple trees. That was what the concern had been about, she realized. The baby had no voice. It couldn't make a sound. Almandine began to pant. She shifted her weight from one hip to the other, and as she looked on and saw his mother continue to sleep, she finally understood. The thing that was going to happen was that her time for training was over, and now, at last, she had a job to do. And so Almandine gathered her legs beneath her and broke her stay. She crossed the room and paused beside the chair, and she became in that moment and was ever after a cautious dog. For it seemed suddenly important that she be right in this. And looking at the two of them there, one silently bawling, one slumped in graceful exhaustion, certainty unfolded in her the way morning light fills a north room. She drew her tongue along his mother's face, just once, very deliberately, then stepped back. His mother startled awake. After a moment, she shifted the blanket and its contents and adjusted her blouse. And soon enough, the whispery sounds the baby had been making were replaced by other sounds Almandine recognized, equally quiet, but these carrying no note of distress. Almandine walked back to where she had been stayed. All of this had happened in the space of a moment or two. And through the pads of her feet, she could feel how her body had warmed a place on the rug. She stood for a long time looking at the two of them. Then she lay down and tucked her nose under the tip of her tail, and she slept. Thanks. One question that I've got a lot lately is, where does this story come from? And I found that a very difficult question to answer because this story draws on a lot of life experience of my own, and it's been very hard to identify discrete things to use to answer that question. But I have come up with three things when I think about it, and they are these. First of all, an interest, a belated interest in the place where I grew up, an interest that only arose after I had moved away and could look at that place from a distance. An interest in the storytelling of the plays of Shakespeare, and most of all, of course, a lifelong engagement with and fascination with dogs. So I want to start by talking about geography and place. The story of Edgar Sawtelle is a very old-fashioned kind of novel. And one way that that's true is that it is very devoted to portraying a place, which is Wisconsin, in fact, northern Wisconsin. And with the exception of a few pages at the beginning of this book and a section near the end, the setting is almost entirely this slightly ramshackle farm that I told you about earlier and that you heard about just now. And here's where I think I can give you probably the one thing that might be useful to you having come to this reading. Because when I read a book that's firmly situated in its place, I like to know where that place actually is. And luckily, we all have with us a pretty good map of Wisconsin, which is the palm side of your right hand. If you look at that, at your hand like that, and hold it out flat like that, your thumb is what's called Door County, and it's sticking out into the middle of Lake Michigan. Lake Superior is draped across the top of your hand like so. I grew up in central Wisconsin, which on your hand is about three-quarters of the way up your palm and smack in the middle. But Edgar's story is located about 4 hours north of there, which lands it up at that crease, that top crease on your middle finger, right about there. Okay, so now you know if you read the book, you'll all say it's happening right here. It'll help, trust me. The nearest town, the nearest real town to that location is Mellon, which is a real place with a real and fascinating history. It's an old logging town, and it happens to have been documented extremely well. 100 years of newspaper articles were compiled by the people who live there into a really wonderful history of the town. Not by coincidence, Mellon is almost exactly the same population as the small town I grew up around of about 600 or 800. Wisconsin's an interesting state in a lot of ways to me now. One way that it's interesting is that it changes radically between where I lived and where the story takes place. About where your fingers attached to your palm, the land changes from a sort of rolling forest and grasslands, which is the dairy farmland that Wisconsin is famous for, to the beginnings of the North Woods or the boreal forest or the Big Woods, which is what it was called back in the logging days. And in the Big Woods, there's more pine and less deciduous trees. There's less farmland, and there's many, many lakes. It has an entirely different feel than the southern half of the state. And by the time you get to Mellon, if you're driving from where I used to live, the houses are few and far between, the weather's different, the culture's different, the economy's different. And in the middle of that area, most importantly for this story, in the middle of that area is a national forest of about 800,000 acres called the Shawamigan National Forest. And that is the other thing that I can tell you that will help you read this book, because you will run into the word Shawamigan. And you will not recognize it from the way I just said it. It looks like you should say Chequamegon, but it's actually pronounced in that area Shawamigan. It's an Indian word, of course, that means place of shallow waters. And the Sawtell Farm is perched on the very edge of the Shawamigan Forest in a tiny clearing in what is still mainly a big woods. And in my imagination, that farm sits on the boundary between the wild world and the domestic world, which is a sort of geographic allusion to one of the recurring concerns of this novel. The second source for this story was interest I had in the theater, an interest that dates back to my earliest childhood. When I was a kid, I assumed I was going to be an actor when I grew up. And in fact, I assumed it so completely that I never actually tried it until I was in summer stock between high school and college. At which point I discovered that not only wasn't I any good at it, I didn't enjoy it either. It was boring and repetitive. It involved mostly standing around. And I simply did not understand it as a craft. I think I was too young to understand anything as a craft at that point, but I certainly didn't understand it. But I was interested in the stories of the plays. And somewhere along the line, very early, I was exposed to Shakespeare. And several of Shakespeare's plays, primarily the tragedies, became sort of bedrock elements of my imagination. And among the things that I was really struck about the stories themselves was the role that the elements play in those stories, wind and rain and fire. People out on the heath in the middle of thunderstorms crashing around them. People washed up on islands after great storms. People wandering around through castles that are so foggy and damp you can almost feel it. And this story, Edgar Sawtell, does draw on some of that bedrock. And in a sense, I think of this novel as a story haunted by another story. Although I always rush to say that the nature of that haunting is, I hope, surprising. And that there are many strands in the braid of this novel. And at least one other strand, for instance, is a somewhat equal obsession of mine with Kipling's The Jungle Book, the Mowgli stories, which are also about wildness and domestication, and which you will find quoted at length in this book. And the final source in my life for this story is this fascination that I have with dogs. And I have to tell you that I spent all day today cutting things out of this section of this talk because my involvement with dogs goes back to my very first memory, and there's just not enough time to talk about it all. But what I do want to tell you is that when I began writing this book, there were many, many nonfiction books available about dog training, dog cognition, dog behavior, and so on. And I'm fascinated by those books. I'm a junkie for that kind of book. I own them all. They're all on a special bookshelf that I have them have at home. But there were very few stories that I could find, contemporary stories, in which a character of a dog appears not as a fictional device or as comic relief, not as, as I like to say, a person in a dog suit, but an actual dog with recognizable traits and dog behaviors and dog limitations and the things that dogs are brilliant at. And I wanted a story in which the stakes for the dog were to be as significant as the stakes for the human beings. As it turned out, I had to go back almost 100 years to Jack London's Call of the Wild, which was published in 1906, to find a story that fit that description. Well, I think we write the stories we wish we could read. Because if this novel attempts one other thing, it is an attempt to be a story about our complex and ancient human relationship with dogs, what that's like, why it's like that, and all the joys and sorrows that come from that. And it's also, in part, a question posed mostly to myself about how far back the human project of living with dogs goes, how deep the roots of that experience goes in us. And also, understanding that that relationship has changed over time, wondering how it will change in the future. I'd been working at the time when I started on this book with a lot of psychologists and linguists, and I was fascinated with the idea, which was suggested by a woman named Vicki Hearn in a book called Adam's Task, that dog training, or animal training in general, but dog training was the subject she was dealing with then, meant engaging in an activity with profound moral and ethical obligations for all parties involved, the people and the dogs. And her argument was that training was most like constructing a private language between a person and a dog. And it was a process that involved agreeing on a vocabulary and agreeing on what every word in that vocabulary meant and going through a series of experiments to try and reveal that meaning. A simple command like wait, for example, can mean both wait while I go through the doorway and then you can come through, or wait here at the curb until I tell you it's okay to walk out into the street, which dogs often think are different, are completely different ideas. And I also noticed, once I understood this, that my dog and other dogs often suggest meanings themselves in inventive ways. And once that was pointed out to me, I began noticing it everywhere. It's one of those ideas that I almost already knew. And once it was in the foreground of my mind, I saw it everywhere. In the case of my dog right now, Lola, we are in the middle of a 7-year argument over the meaning of the doorbell. My position is that usually means something good when the doorbell rings. Lola claims that the siege that she's been expecting all along has finally started. And in truth, I'm not actually all that interested in convincing her otherwise. What I'm interested in is the conversation between us about that. And that's what I think the relationship between humans and dogs is at its best. This careful mutual refinement of meaning. And to me, that's where a lot of the joy comes from living with a dog. In terms of the actual writing, I'm embarrassed to say that it's very simple. That an idea came to me one day that wove all these interests together in a way that was plausible enough to me that I felt like I could get started. And very quickly, actually in the matter of a few hours, I had the broad outlines of the book in my mind. Now, of course, that's only what got me off the couch and in front of the keyboard, because it was as Christine said, about 10 years of work in round numbers to get the book to a point where I liked it. And that's what you see today. So thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Jeff Shara and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on June 10th, 2008.